You're listening to St. PDEX Season 2. Today's episode is brought to you by CapEx Advisory Group. When organizations undertake large capital or real estate projects, they turn to CapEx for additional resources and expertise. To learn what an owner's rep can do for you, visit CapEx's website at ceag2.com. That's C-E-A-G, the number 2.com. And by the Open Partnership Education Network, located at the University of South Florida in St. Petersburg. The world is open for citizens, businesses, groups, for all of us to become a smarter, better connected city by learning together. To find out more about Open, including upcoming great Aresti speakers, please visit learnopen.org. Now enjoy the conversation. I'm sitting today at the home of iconic photographer, social documentarian through photos, Herb Snitzer. Good to see you, sir.
Nice to see you too. Thanks.
Well, you're most known for your photography. So let's start with exploring that a little bit. What makes a good photograph?
Like any piece of art, it has to touch the soul of the person. And on that level, I've spent 60 years making images that convey this attitude.
And when you go about to start to make a photo, how are you interacting with your subject matter? How are you experiencing it, and how are you framing it?
Well, sometimes in a very cohesive way, where I get to know the subject that I'm photographing. So many times when I was working for Life or Look magazine back in the days, you didn't have much time with the subject that you were commissioned to photograph. Mm-hmm. But in the jazz world, which I lived in that world for a number of years, I got to know many of the wonderful players. And it wasn't difficult to try to find a little bit of humanity or a lot of humanity in the people I was photographing. I love jazz musicians and jazz singers.
Sure. So when you get magic in a photograph, how often do you know it when it's happening because of perhaps your relationship with the subject matter or the person in the photograph? And how often does it come to you when you're actually developing the shots later on?
Well, developing the image that you were going after, that's a mechanical way of looking at any art. I have to relate to the person or to the people. I have to show them my side of life. And once I was able to do that and recognize that it was happening time and time again, I realized that I was doing something that not too many other photographers were doing.
And you think most of that comes in the eye, in the front end?
Well, it comes in the heart.
In the heart.
Yeah, I say to my young students, tell me how you feel about what you've created. It's not just a mechanical thing. I mean, photographers are human beings, and some are nice people, others are not nice people. Mm-hmm. And it boils down to just what your thoughts and feelings are for what you're doing. Now, when it was a commercial gig, that's one thing. But when it was my own feelings about things, sometimes it worked. Sometimes it didn't. But every time I was able to deliver an image that has lasted for 60 years.
Yeah.
I mean, a long time.
Sure. You famously resisted moving to digital for quite a while, saying that it didn't give you the same connection. When you sort of map that onto students and they're trying to connect with their heart to the subject matter, do you feel like the proliferation of digital tools and, you know, just even the economies of being able to shoot infinite photos without having to pay for film and developing has been ultimately a good thing in what it's opened up in photography for the world, or something that's hurt the craft overall?
Well, commercially, photography is still doing what it has done for 150 years, which is what we call the wet process. Mm. Now we have the dry process, and I don't put a lot of emphasis on digital photography because of the result. The quality of the result is what I'm after. I'm after a luminosity of paper, and opportunity to contemplate when I did my developing. It was a slower process. And for me, it was a more thoughtful process. When I get in the dark room, you know, it's me and that enlarger. It's me and that piece of film. And I'm conflicted with it because I come from a different generation. And some of the things that are done digitally, especially with sports photography, it's like, boy, those guys are really good. They're really good. They really get the moment. But then they move on. Whereas for me, I stick around and try to understand what I've done because a lot of it is intuitive. Mm-hmm. You know, artists are not like these pieces here. They came about because of my feelings about voting and my fear about what may be occurring on November 4th. So this is more a tribute to John Lewis, who I happened to meet in Washington one time and just was awe-inspiring to shake his hand.
So continuing on the thread with regard to the time in the dark room, do you think that is a valuable time in developing, you know, the full photographer as an artist that you lose when you're just cranking out hundreds of digital shots?
Yeah, I think if you have the time to think about what you're doing, to understand the assets and limitations of wet photography, so to speak, it's a wonderful quiet. It's almost like a Buddha quiet when I'm in the darkroom. I mean, when I first started out, I could be in the darkroom 18 hours straight. I don't do that anymore. I don't have a darkroom anymore, but I still photograph.
Yeah.
And I can always have it processed. So then what do I do with the contact sheet and the negative? You know, I've got to find resources that will enable me to make images, which I have found in the art center here in the Morian Art Center downtown. They have a full wet darkroom, and it's just not the place to be right now, but it certainly is a wonderful venue, and they let me use their darkroom facilities, which is terrific.
Jazz is obviously a big part of your canon, and you did a lot of that work on assignment. And I think before we get into looking at how jazz juxtaposes against the other pieces of your career, let's dive into jazz a little bit. One thing that you've remarked on previously is how hard it was for jazz musicians to just get by, and everything from the standard struggles of making a living as a musician to the racism and just the difficulty, you know, the expectations. So as you look back on your relationship with jazz in those times, you were covering the greats, you know, what stands out most for you?
Their humanity. I love jazz musicians. I just think they're just wonderful people. And as a metaphor, I see the music as a cry for freedom. And it started with my interest with the bebop era and moved forward. But that was protest music. That was Dizzy Gillespie saying, I can do whatever I want to do. If I want to put my horn up in the air, I'm going to do that. Or Louis Armstrong, who talked down Fidel Castro, saying he's no spy, referring to himself, that I'm no spy. John Coltrane in his protest music, I mean, Max Roach, Abby Lincoln, all during that period of time, saying we're people. And it juxtaposed, right, with the freedom movement. So it was something to experience. And it's continued to this very day, like Black Matters.
How apparent was it when you were going through it? Did you know you were in a special place in time, or did you sort of understand that a little bit later on?
A little bit later on. What I was doing in the early part of my career was basically to establish myself in New York,
right,
as a young photographer, documentary photographer, which I was able to do, and ended up photographing for Life magazine, which was a thrill all by itself for somebody so young and so inexperienced, really. It was a glorious time. And musicians, they're not brain dead, you know? They really do understand life's issues because they were always traveling, and being in the South was it was like combat pay.
Yeah.
You know, it was frightening. I remember when Brown v. Board was passed by the Supreme Court in 1954. I was in the Army then. I was drafted in the Army, and I was stationed in the South. And I was friends with a couple African-American kids who were also drafted. And we were in uniform, and we're in this bar. We walk into this club. I forget where it was. And dead silence. You know, I was like the only white face in the crowd. And the bartender said, "You better get out of here, kid, because I don't think you'll be welcomed."
Mm.
You know, but I was naive enough to just be able to walk in. Now, conversely, during that same period of time, audiences were segregated. When I first went to Richmond, Virginia, I wanted to see the ballet theater from New York. They were performing, and the audience, the African Americans, were up in the balcony, mm-hmm. on the right side of the theater, and they were dressed to the nines. I mean, it was just such a paradox for me, you know, and they were dignified. They were middle-class Black people, teachers, so on. And I thought, man, I'd love to have them as neighbors, you know, just beautiful people.
So, you know, the nation being the way it was at the time, how did that affect your paradigm traveling with them? I know you were close with Nina Simone. You took some bus trips. You know, were you slow to be trusted, or did you feel like you just connected in a way completely outside of that?
Yeah, no, I was trusted almost right away. It was because I was paying attention to the musicians. I wasn't just listening to their music. I was talking with them, hanging out with them, smoking a little dope with them, you know. It was an experience that I was able to recreate when I moved to Florida and joined the St. Pete NAACP branch, in which it was so different from what I was experiencing as a new resident of St. Petersburg. I mean, my goodness.
Different in what way?
Well, different in things were going on in the city regarding wages, regarding employment, which were not altogether known by the majority of people. Central Avenue, as you may know, was the dividing line. Whites lived in the south part of town, and Blacks live on the south side. And so it almost branded you if you said you lived south, you know, First Avenue South, 34th Street South. So it's affected me, and it affected the way that I look at people.
But you had a sensitivity to prejudice from your earliest days.
Oh, yeah. It just didn't come out of the blue. I mean, my parents were pogromed out of the Ukraine. They came to America as refugees. I'm first generation American.
You tell a story of when you your first string quarterback went down on your high school football team, and there was an African American and yourself, and the coach decided to put the African-American into play, but asked you to choose the plays.
Yeah, well, that was wonderful on one hand, because it sort of substantiated me as a player.
Right.
But on the other hand, it was a totally racist thing for him to do. And so you begin to wake up. It was a little slow for me, but I woke up. And what I woke up to was something that I didn't want to be a part of. So I did what I had to do photographically to bring myself and others together. I've always seen my role as being a visual historian with an edge for disruptions, so we say, you know.
And when one looks at your full body of work, that's clear. You've gotten I would say arguably most of your commercial success and fame around the jazz work. How does that sit with you? Obviously, jazz was a real blessing for you. Do you feel to some extent it pigeonholed you at all, or are you just wholly grateful for it?
Oh, no, I loved what I was doing. I have no regrets about leaving the jazz world when I had the opportunity to work in a Summerhill-type school for 13 years.
Right.
And it was just a glorious time. It was the Beat Generation. It was the Beatles. And again, they were on the edge. These were young kids. I mean, Bob Dylan was 24 years old. I have great stories about him and me, but
I'd love to hear one.
Well, it's more sad than anything else when I was so involved with the jazz world. Bob Dylan was a block away at one of the coffee houses in New York. And I didn't go down. I just stayed. So I never did meet him until years and years later. And I told him the story. It was pretty funny.
So there's a lot of mythology in there. I was a Beat fan myself. You know, and imagine, you know, Ginsberg showing up to watch Dylan play in one of those little coffee houses in Soho or wherever. So understanding what a part of history you were and understanding that through those images, that's how history largely gets made. How did sort of mythology and placemaking, and how did that shape your career and storytelling coming out of that time?
Not so much.
No?
Not so much. I was a working artist, and instead of using paintbrushes, I used light. And, you know, somebody asked Eugene Smith if he used available light as opposed to studio light.
Right.
And Gene said, I'll use any light that's available. That's what it is for us. I mean, the way light is falling on your face, it's kind of almost sinister.
Sinister?
Yeah.
Pick a different adjective, Herb. Come on. How about angelic? You had, you know, an interesting front row seat to some of the personalities, specifically in jazz. One of the, we'll say, to be kind, enigmas was Miles Davis. And I think you used a quote where you say you take your hat off, or you quoted somebody else as saying they would take their hat off to the artist and put it back on.
Yeah, Toscanini.
Toscanini, yes.
Yeah, thank you.
What's the scoop on Miles? Was he a tortured artist? Was he angry?
He tried to come off as being very hurt and very deprived. He came out of a middle class environment. In East St. Louis, his father was a dentist. He went to the right schools. I mean, and somewhere along the line, he became a different person. My theory is that he was growing up at the same time that Clifford Brown was playing. And Miles grabbed all of the attention. Mm. And what happened is Clifford was killed on the Pennsylvania Highway. He was going for a gig, and it was snowing and sleeting, and he got into an awful crash, which killed him and I think one of his other players. And Miles knew this. Obviously, we all knew it. If Clifford had lived, here's a young man who had five CDs or five records before he was 25 years old. I mean, just an outstanding, creative, young man, lost to history in a way. Mm-hmm. And Miles knew that if Clifford had continued to play, that people would be talking about Clifford Brown and not Miles Davis. That's a pretty strong statement to make. Like, who am I to say Miles Davis is a terrible player? He wasn't.
Sure.
But he was tortured and not very kind to women.
Do you attribute his middle-class upbringing to, you know, an insecurity around his authenticity to be part of that group? Or is he just entitled, or is it really just baked into his personality?
No, I just think Miles felt entitled.
Entitled.
Yeah. He was a great player. Can't take anything away from him. He's a great player. And I met him in 1960. That's 60 years ago at the Apollo Theater, the great Apollo Theater in Harlem.
Did you feel like it got worse or better as he got more successful, had more money?
As a person?
As a person.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was living in Cambridge, and the Boston Globe Jazz Festival was organized by George Ween, the producer. So we're both at the theater in Boston, and Freddie, and I forget his last name, the producer of the Boston Globe Jazz Festival, said to me, Miles doesn't want you backstage.
You specifically?
Yes, specifically. So I said, well, what's he going to do if I'm backstage? Hit me? You know, I'm a little guy. So I'm backstage because that's where I wanted to be to do what I needed to do.
Right.
And Miles is facing the audience. So I'm facing Miles back. Mm-hmm. I must have made a noise or something, but he looked back and he takes his sunglasses and goes like this. And I thought, terrific. I got what I want. And let's see if I can get out of here in one piece. You know? And Miles glaring at me. Uh-huh. He knew me for 30 years, for goodness sake. He just glared at me, and I just stood my ground and looked back at him, figuring, what's he going to do? Come on stage? Make a scene? So that gave me a terrific image.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Yeah.
Intensity.
Very intense.
You know, that seems aggressive for him to single you out and to say
that. No, all photographers. He didn't want any photographers backstage.
Got it.
And there weren't that many to begin with in those days. It's not like today. So if there were three of us back there, the other two guys took off.
Right. So you got the only shot.
I got the only image of that time, yeah.
And how did that play in the rest of the jazz community? Did the other musicians feel similarly about him as far as you could tell?
Yeah, some did.
Yeah.
Some did. I'd rather not name names.
Sure, sure.
But some did.
Let's flip over to a sweeter personality. I think you said you were closest with Nina Simone.
Yeah, for a long time. She was a real true love, so to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I met her doing a commercial assignment for Colpix Records, Columbia Records in those days. And they hired me to do a series of photographs on Nina. And I had never met her before. But we just hit it off. I mean, we just took to each other like a duck to water. I mean, it was just astounding. And I kept in touch with Nina for years. And then because I moved out of New York and was involved with this free school, I didn't see her for quite a number of years.
Right.
But then I was able to, with contacts, talk to the producer of the Barron Jazz Festival. And he hired me for 3 years in a row to come to Switzerland to photograph.
That's a good gig.
And one thing led to another, and Nina and I got together again and just had a wonderful time. I didn't buy into it. She was difficult. You talk about a difficult person. Nina was very difficult, but it never washed over me. She and I just had a great time.
So at some point in your career, you transitioned from, you know, working photographer type of gigs, you know, through sort of a few other iterations, but ultimately ended up at a place where you are a known photographer who people collect your work. You have a website, you know, you do limited edition prints. So talk about how that grew in you in that transition to the place where you are now, where your name has a great value in the photographic community, and how that sort of, you know, sprouted in your life.
Well, it wasn't so much an either or. While I was doing the jazz, I was a documentary life photographer. I was having other assignments rather than just the jazz, like Duke and Duchess of Windsor, Betty Davis, Tennessee Williams. These are not jazz people, but they were assignments from the New York Times. And my photography was my life. Mm-hmm. I was consumed with making photographs. I just was so fascinated, so taken aback by what I considered magical moments,
right,
that it just kept me going. I mean, I would carry my camera around all the time.
Sure.
And we did that. That was part of being a documentary photographer in those days. You were privy to other photographers who were doing the same thing. And when we would meet each other, we'd talk about things and so on. It wasn't so isolating. The darkroom was isolating,
right,
which I loved. But I also enjoyed the idea of just walking the streets of New York.
Right. So then when did you decide to, you know, start publishing books and selling prints and going down that road?
Well, almost from the beginning. It just was almost a fluke. I knew Nat Hentoff. Mm-hmm. Nat was a great writer, constitutional writer for the New York Times. And I said to him that I've done a book on Central Park. And what I would like to do is meet an editor here in New York who would understand my images, which were very poetic. And he gave me the name of Emil Capuia, who, by the way, his son lives here. And when I met his son, I said to him, I said, "Are you related to Emil Capuia?" And he said, "He was my father."
Wow.
I lost it at that time. I didn't know what to say. I was just so overwhelmed with feelings because Emil gave me my first break as far as books. He hired me to photograph a radical school in England, in which I then flew to England and photographed this school for many months. And life just flowed. It was really one thing led to another, which led to another.
Right. But now you have a successful business. You command good money for your prints. And yeah. So I'm just, you know, really curious as that's the, not for all photographers, but obviously many photographers wouldn't mind if that happened, where they got to a point where they had the name recognition and the quality to A, have a career as long as you've had, but then also get to a point where there's a collectability around your work.
Well, you live long enough, I guess that's
what
happens.
Is that the trick?
Yeah, don't die.
So that doesn't move the needle for you at all, that sort of recognition, knowing that you'll go down in history as a really lauded collectible photographer? I think that's a fantastic achievement.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't make much of it when people come and look at, not now, I mean, this virus has brought me to a standstill at this point.
And when you go down that road, I'm curious about even things like pricing prints. And, you know, I find art pricing fascinating. You feel like you could take a piece and maybe put it on the wrong gallery or the wrong store in Central Avenue and price it $500 and it would never sell. And you could take the same piece of art and put it on the right gallery in Miami and put $50,000 on it and it might sell in 2 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a strange psychology.
Well, it's a crapshoot. I mean, especially now that photography has been recognized by the kings, the people who matter, so as I say it.
Right.
It's like this portfolio that I have, this jazz portfolio, 75 issues of the portfolio, 10 prints, 10 beautifully produced mm-hmm. prints. And when we started out, Gus Kayafis, the producer, he was either giving them to certain people in the photographic world or selling them for $1,500 for the 10 prints. Right now, today, it's priced at 10.
10,000.
10,000 now. Same prints. I didn't do anything other than supply the negative to Gus, and he got the producers and all involved.
Are you saying that he was strategic in who he gave those to sort of seed the interest?
Oh, yeah. It became a marketing tool, and some of these guys demanded very high money from. Like, I have a portfolio by one of the great 20th century photographers. Mm-hmm. I was a very close friend of him. And I have this portfolio that he produced, only 5 copies. I have number one. It's now worth about $50,000, the portfolio. But when I got it, it was nowhere near that.
Right.
So it's just like any other demand. The it became a commodity.
What sort of persona do you think is the biggest driver of that? Is it the strategic buyer who sets the trends? Is it the broker in the middle?
No, the buyer. There were two men who collected photography.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, besides Alfred Stieglitz, who was the father of us all.
Right.
But these two men put a lot of money in politics and their standing in the community. And all of a sudden, it broke loose. And then photography became a real expensive commodity.
And when you refer to the kings deemed it, is that who you were referring
to? Yeah, the people who really run the photographic galleries, the photographic shows,
right,
the articles on photography.
Making a market.
Yeah, it's a market. And my experience with that is not very good.
Why not?
Well, in their terms, I live down here and I'm not interacting socially. I'm not going out and spending money, buying gifts and all this kind of stuff that photographers thought they needed to do. I never did.
Do you feel like the internet and the connectedness of the world has changed that at all, or is it still largely?
Yeah, I work directly through the computer.
Yeah.
And we're not talking about millions of dollars here, although I do have an archive, which I've been trying to place,
right,
which is now valued at $1.5 million.
Wow. So tell me a little bit about the archive.
Well, it's all my work. It's 100,000 negatives, 1,000 prints. I have it all up here.
Do you feel like the reproducibility of photographs made it tougher sledding than, say, an oil painting? That was just, you know, there
well,
was just
that's always been the argument with photography. But, you know, the art world can produce prints, can produce other ways to make an image. I consider each print that I make an original print.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an afterthought. It's an original print. And I limit prints. And so it's just part and parcel of the art world. I started off as a painter. I painted for years. I found that I was better making pictures than painting. So that's where we are.
You know, before we move, I know we talked about the jazz musicians and the experiences you've had with racism throughout your life, or observed and felt a need to take pictures that showed your feelings about it. So I wanted to spend a little more time on that because I think it's a very important topic. Can you talk a little bit about how the jazz musicians struggled and the people that whoever you worked with at that time, how their livelihoods, careers, and sort of beings were affected?
Sure. Louis Armstrong,
mm-hmm,
that mural of Louis Armstrong, was made on a bus tour that I took with Pops and his band. Leaving his home in Flushing, getting onto whatever that road is, Pops had to go to the bathroom. It was a bus with no air conditioning and very few amenities. And so we stopped the bus. Pops got out, went into this diner, and we were told to just wait. And he comes out looking so angry. This is in Connecticut now. He was refused to use bathroom facilities. And the only explanation I came up with is because he was Black. And I never forgot the look. As a matter of fact, I made a couple photographs of him walking across the street. And here he was. You know, Pops was a little guy. He was like my size. If you could believe it, he can blow a horn. And he is not recognizable by many people. He had on shorts. He had his shirt open. It was a hot June day. So that's one example. Coming back from Tanglewood at 2 in the morning, we stopped at a diner, an all-night diner. Here's Louis Armstrong, the most recognizable voice
mm-hmm
in the world, sitting in this diner at 2 o'clock in the morning, having a cup of coffee. But before he got there, the road manager went into the diner to make sure that it would be okay if Louis Armstrong came in and got a cup of coffee. Well, they were thrilled, but it showed me that they were also very, very cautious, because you never know, like today, you never know whether some crazy white supremacist would pull a gun. You know, in those days, it was just as volatile. So when the road manager said it was okay, all the musicians, Trummy Young, Mort Herbert, they all came into the diner and we had a party. We had a party going. The guy who owned the diner was thrilled, you know, the great Louis Armstrong, but you never knew what was going to happen. So,
and how about St. Petersburg specifically? You've been here for many decades. You live south of Central Avenue in Lakewood Estates. And how do you feel St. Petersburg has done in your time here with regard to equity?
Oh, it's changed dramatically, just dramatically. There were no Jewish real estate people downtown. This is the white world now, downtown. You want to see where they all were? Clearwater. Hmm. The doctors went to Clearwater. It was segregated. And that's gone now. I mean, I like to think that we've grown up. We've become a bigger city. And it has, from an art standpoint. When I first moved here, I couldn't believe what I was moving into.
Well, you've been a big part of that.
Yeah, so I got involved with Salt Creek Artworks, and we kept it going for many years. And it left a mark.
So as you're now moving into the, we'll say, the second half of your career?
Oh, this is the third half.
The third half, okay.
You know, I struggle with Parkinson's,
which
is no fun. But I keep making photographs. I keep photographing and hope for the best.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've made it to the end of another great episode. For more SPX, visit stpetx.com. Thanks again to our sponsors, CapEx Advisory Group, Build with Confidence. CapEx provides owners representation for the most demanding construction projects. With deep knowledge of design, finance, construction, and public policy, CapEx brings your project to life. CapEx supports your organization with leadership and expertise to reduce cost and ease the burden on your team. Discover what an owner's rep can do for you. Discover CapEx Advisory Group. Visit ceag2.com. That's CEAG, the number 2.com. And thanks also again to OPEN, the Open Partnership Education Network, which puts on great events around St. Petersburg, including Arresty Speakers. To see the upcoming calendar of events, visit learnopen.org.